The Burrows of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another, and we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes. Oops, oops, oops.
You are listening to the Burrows of Berea.
Well, welcome back to the Burrows of Berea. I am Rick Welch, and to my right is Rick Big Daddy Carter.
Oh, yeah.
Man, can you make that go on both sides? Kind of like pan it back and forth, Andy?
Yes, absolutely.
I can run around the room.
Yeah.
I can run around you.
And behind the glass is Rocket Man Andy Bishop.
Cal.
And to my left is the Honorable Sarita, the Edge Edgerton.
Hello.
You representing?
Represent.
Yes, we are back to our study after that formal apology for Daniel chapter 5 and 6 that I gave because we went off the rails.
Yeah, that was
fun. This one isn't going to be as funny, and it's not because Sarita's here. It's because this one is where we start to really get deep, especially when you start thinking about eschatology. I had somebody tell me the other day, I don't worry about eschatology because it just gets you off track. You just need to read your Bible. And I said, 33% of the Bible is eschatology. So what are you saying exactly? And the fact is, the Bible is slap full of eschatology. And I've really looked into this. I've got a lot
of
notes.
For a boy from Maine, you sure did use that Southern term.
Well, I'm not from Maine.
Slap full.
Slap full. I was born in Michigan, lived in Maine until I was almost 5, and then we moved here. And so I was raised Southern by the grace of God. That's what I tell everybody anyway. So we are just going to kick this right off. We don't have Billy. We don't have Tiziana. We don't have Ralph. They will hopefully be here next time, but we do have Sarita back, which is awesome. We're going to take advantage of this to get you in on a Daniel study. So would you please, how many verses are in this?
28.
That's a lot, isn't it?
It is. So mine is broken up into Daniel's vision of the four beasts, the Ancient of Days reigns, Daniel's vision enters.
Well, then let's read it in broken up because, like okay. Andy says, reading a whole lot is boring.
Yes.
So let's read it
read
with the
first
broken
section.
Up.
Okay. Daniel chapter 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then, as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, arise and devour much flesh.
I wish I had 3 ribs in my mouth between my teeth.
Too. That sounds yummy. After this, I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces, stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it. It had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things.
Hmm. So right off the bat, let's just go ahead, because if it hadn't have been for Sarita, I probably never would have looked this up in the first place. But this is going to sound very familiar. If you remember, you had told us that there was a chiastic structure. So here's what I got from my notes. It says the book of Daniel is structured chiastically with Aramaic chapters 2 through 7, forming a literary arc that centers on Daniel 4 and 5, while the Hebrew sections, chapter 1 and then 8 through 12, serve different thematic functions. Chapter 7 concludes the Aramaic chiasm and mirrors chapter 2 in theme. So the layout is chapter 2 had 4 kingdoms and God's eternal kingdom. Chapter 3 had deliverance from Gentile persecution. Chapter 4 had the humbling of a Babylonian king. Chapter 5 had the fall of a Babylonian king. Chapter 6 was deliverance from Gentile persecution. And chapter 7 was four kingdoms and God's eternal kingdom and in visionary form. So if we remember, chapter 2, it wasn't Daniel's dream, it was Nebuchadnezzar's. So Nebuchadnezzar was seeing something, but now Daniel is seeing this. So it's unique. So some believe within scholarship and as well as theologians that because this is the counterpart of Daniel chapter 2, that it's a prophetic counterpart, that it's looking forward much like this, but offering a more apocalyptic and symbolic vision of the same historical reality. And so the vision aligns symbolically and thematically with the trajectory of redemptive history coming to a climax. And you and I, Sarita, we don't have to get like super deep into this, but we both have a different view. I was raised dispensational. So hearing this, the first beast being Babylon, which we already know because it was said in Daniel chapter 2 that he was the first empire. So the next empire that comes in Daniel, we've learned in chapter 6, or in chapter 5 and 6, was that the Medo-Persians come in. And so that's the next major empire. And then we know that later on that empire is going to be overthrown by Greece. And what I was always taught was that after the fall of Alexander and the Seleucids, I believe it is that what they're called, the Seleucids? Then you had Rome, that Rome was the next giant empire that would have fit within the categories of historical empires. But I think you've read and done some research and have heard views about the Islamic Caliphate before, right?
So, yes. So when you look at the destruction and the complete domination of the known world, Rome didn't necessarily do that.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't dominate people. They assimilated, kind of like we do. We try to assimilate people into our culture. Of course, we're not out taking over countries like Rome did. But, you know, if you were taken captive, you could work off your service mm-hmm. by being in the Roman military.
Right.
They didn't necessarily, I mean, I'm sure they did kill people.
Yeah.
But they didn't try to kill out entire people groups. And they're one of the very first that did it on a larger scale where they saved entire people, not entire people groups, but, you know.
Rome was happy to keep you if you paid taxes. Yeah, but if you didn't.
You're done.
They killed you a lot.
That's correct. Right. But, you know, like Babylon goes in and kills all the Jews to a remnant and then slices off their hoo-has and then takes them away as slaves. I mean, they until the Lord says, send them back. So when you're looking at utter domination, the only, and this is just from a historical perspective, the only other person that it could be would be the Islamic Caliphate that happened where they took over almost all of Spain. And they didn't get that back until Ferdinand and Isabella, king and queen, mm-hmm. married one another, joined their two regions of Spain. And then I think it took like 10 or 15 years and kicked the Moor, that we call them the Moors. But if you look at, and I had given, I think, did I give you those charts I had?
I think you did, actually.
Comparing the Roman Empire mm-hmm. to the Islamic Empire, Rome went more west.
Yeah.
Whereas when we're looking at biblical stuff, it always centers around the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
Israel. Right. Israel's a focal point. And I think we would agree that oftentimes we see ourselves as the focal point.
Yeah.
The United States, Americans, the West, yes. We see ourselves as
big
the focal
shock.
Point. We're. But a lot of this prophecy was written with Israel as the center point of it. So when you're looking at kingdoms that took over and completely dominated that area, it was the Islamic Caliphate.
Mm-hmm.
And so they also have a vision of apocalyptic times.
Yeah.
If you've ever heard of that, the 12th Imam, they're trying to usher him back in now.
Yeah.
They want him to come in because they see him as their Messiah.
Right.
And he is supposed to dominate the entire world.
Right.
That's what they believe.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of lines up if you're looking at an Antichrist from a futurist perspective.
Right.
Not one that's already come or is spiritual or theoretical. That's what we're expecting it's almost complete domination. Though there are going to be kingdoms that try to oppose him, depending on how you read it, of course. Not everybody's going to fall in line with it. I'm certainly not falling in line with it. It's not, you won't catch me bowing down to Muhammad. You'll slice my head off first before right, I do right. that. And I think a lot of Americans may.
I've also heard from your view that one of the strong points is that this beast, it's like this great beheader. And mm-hmm. that seems to be the thing that the Islamists do, whereas the Romans were more into crucifixion.
Yes, they're really the only group of people that uses, and they're using it now. Right. In Nigeria, they just took 70 Christians, put them in a church, and beheaded them one by one about three, four weeks ago.
Right.
I mean, they're currently beheading Christians. Mm-hmm. Nigeria is having such a crisis of persecution right now. It's so bad. But we've also seen those videos from when they had the guys on their knees and
yes.
the Muslims behind them who were beheading them. And of course, that's a fringe group. Just like any religion has a fringe group, you know, go listen to Rick's cult podcast that he has if you're a Patreon member. Those are fringe religious Christian groups.
Yep.
So yeah, that's kind of where I feel like if you're a futurist, that maybe it won't be a resurrected Roman Empire like we've been left behind, learned right, to believe.
Right, the dispensational view.
So that's kind of where I've come down on it.
Yeah.
If I'm going to be a futurist.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So I wanted you to be able to present that you had a different view. I still hold to that, even though it's dispensational, you know, we learn it, I still hold to those major four. I have my reasons, and we'll get into that later, but this isn't about me trying to prove you wrong or anything. So let's just get that out of the way. I wanted you to be able to state your view. And Andy, what's your view? Okay.
About the future?
Yeah, what's your view about the four beasts?
I only believe in one god. His name is Zorgon, and he lives in the lake behind my house.
Oh, I had somebody was talking to me
the
other day.
You have a lake behind your house?
Yeah.
It's very little.
Okay.
It's more of a cup of water.
And there's also the flying spaghetti monster.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I had a guy tell me that the other day.
I actually have the yep. bonefish on the inside of my arm.
That's right. Yeah. I also asked that guy if the flying spaghetti monster, if the form of religion was Pastafarian.
Yes.
Which, yeah. right? Pastafarianism.
Pastafarian. That's awesome. Funny.
Yeah, they were doing this thing for a while where if you were brave enough, people were like saying that a colander was religious headgear and insisting that they take their driver's license photos with colanders on their heads. Yeah, some of them got away with it. It was great.
Wow.
It's amazing.
So, Rick, I'll just bring you into with your view. Do you hold to more of the standard view, the Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece?
I do.
And Rome? Okay. So here's something that we can do right out of the gate. We can cross-reference with Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. The statue parallels the four beasts. But if you look also in Revelation chapter 13, verse 1 through 2, you see the composite beast, which echoes Daniel 7's imagery. But the linchpin, in my opinion, in this argument is what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 24, verse 15, where he references Daniel when warning of Jerusalem's judgment and how it connects to Luke 21, when he says it's the armies and that they themselves would see it from an audience relevance point of view, right? If audience relevance actually matters. All right, so let's see. How many verses did you read?
I think 8.
Yes, 8.
Okay.
And then we go to the heavenly courtroom scene, the Ancient
right.
of Days.
Okay, so in Daniel chapter 7, verse 8, the little horn, the identity is a blasphemous persecuting power rising from the fourth beast. I've heard this even within like the full preterist circles, that they see this little horn that's most likely the Herodian priesthood or the high priestly leadership. I've done a lot of work recently, a lot of research on the Herodian priesthood, and I discovered that they are actually descendants of Esau, and I can actually track it. I can track it all the way down. So they became the Edomites. They became Edomians.
We've talked about that a little bit.
Yes, and then that Herod actually put them in power. So this priesthood that Herod puts in is considered an apostate priesthood at that time, and that's one of, you know, Jesus is talking to them directly, people like Caiaphas and them. So it makes war with the saints, which echoes Matthew 23 and also Acts 4 through 7, where Jewish authorities are persecuting believers. And it changes time and law, likely a reference to religious corruption and messianic resistance. And I looked up some scholar. Are you guys familiar with Milton Terry and biblical hermeneutics or biblical apocalyptics? You ever read those or heard of them?
I have not heard
of them. So he was a theologian and scholar from the late 1800s. And in biblical apocalyptics, he says he interpreted Little Horn as tied to Jewish leadership in the first century. And J. Stuart Russell places Daniel's fulfillment in the Jewish-Roman conflict. All right, so we've pretty much shown that Daniel 9 and Daniel 2 mirror one another. We have differences of opinion. That's fine. Let's go on. Let's go further. Will you go ahead and read 9 through 14?
As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I then looked, because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body was destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time.
Very good. So the first thing to notice is the Ancient of Days. And prior, this has always been considered God, right?
Right.
Now, there's... Even within preterist circles, I'll say there's a distinct difference. And Dr. Sam Frost even says this, that they don't believe that when the Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days, that it's talking about the Second Coming. They'll say that it's not the Second Coming, but the Ascension of Christ, where Jesus receives the kingdom. That's where they're, because this is about the Messiah. It's about the Son of Man. It's a future thing about Christ. But then like Michael Sullivan and Don Preston and a lot of others have went back on that, especially with the Greek Septuagint, and said, this is a misunderstanding. Basically through the translation, it's actually that he is as the Ancient of Days. And then if you follow what's saying afterward, that it's obvious that it's a part of this judgment theme that's going on. Now that's that's above my pay grade, just so we all know. And I'm not going to get into that.
Mine doesn't say as. Mine says the Ancient of Days took his seat.
Yes, which means that it's the Ancient of Days. So would you say that this is the Messiah is God?
I've always seen this as this being God.
Right.
Like what is the analogy about salvation? That God is on the judgment seat, but Jesus is our attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Or Jesus steps.
The divine prosecutor.
Yeah, he steps in front of us and says, I've already taken this person. This person's punishment has been paid for.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So the Son of Man.
But that could be flawed. I mean, that could just be a flawed analogy. But.
Right. So the cross references that I discovered here, Matthew 26:64, when Jesus says, you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds. He's talking to the high priest. Acts chapter 2, 33, verse 36, Peter declares that Jesus was enthroned in heaven. So he takes his seat. Revelation 5, the Lamb receives authority from the one on the throne, like you just said, the prosecutor. He receives authority from the one on the throne. So it vindicates, basically the vision is vindicating, and if we look forward to Jesus, this is a Daniel study. If you look forward to Jesus as Messiah, it vindicates Jesus post-resurrection, right? Showing him that he is the king. Now, let's see here. Let me see. You read to verse 14, correct? All right.
No, verse 12.
Verse 12, okay. So before we get into this, the eschatology of it, I want to think about what Daniel must have been thinking in his head when he's reading this. Because he's just described these major empires prior to this, in the first 8 verses, these major empires. But then he continues on, and now he sees the Ancient of Days taking his seat. The clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. When you go to Revelation, and you get to the beginning of Revelation, and it starts describing Jesus, it's describing him like this. It's showing that Jesus is the Ancient of Days. That's what it's doing. It's literally symbolically putting them together. His throne was fiery flames and its wheels were burning fire. So a stream of fire issued and came out from before him. A thousand thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him, and the court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. Again, you go to Revelation, and who is worthy to open the scroll? It's the Lamb. The Lamb is the only one that's worthy enough to open the scroll. So it's pretty obvious that there's a juxtaposition being shown here, because he says, I looked then because of a sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. So it's kind of weird because these beasts he's talking about, we're looking at beasts across empires.
Right.
Over time.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
So how is it that this one beast with the horn is killed, but the other ones remain? Do you understand my question?
Yes.
Do you understand my question?
Mm-hmm.
Let's think about it as far as time frame, because if we say, okay, it's describing the empires like chapter 2, the way that Daniel described it. So here, when he's looking forward at it, now he's at this place where this beast is destroyed, but the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. What does that mean? Have you ever thought of that?
Their lives?
It says it right here. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking, and as I looked, the beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. If we're talking about that particular beast, to me, it sounds like...
That's referring to the horns, not the beast
itself. That's correct.
The horns are separate from the beast.
Mm-hmm.
The beast isn't affected, but the horns are.
Yes.
And according to the original part, there's 10.
It says the beast was killed.
The beast was killed?
That's what it says. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking, and as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire.
The beast is... whatever kingdom we're calling it. So for you, Rome, for me, the Islamic Caliphate.
When was Rome ever burned with fire? When were they destroyed by fire? They weren't. There was one nation in that fourth kingdom that was destroyed by fire.
Well, Rome was set on fire.
That was a personal
he played the fiddle. He played the fiddle while Rome burned, mm-hmm. Isn't that something? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't burn down to basically to describe all of it being destroyed. No.
So what's going on here? To me, the way that I'm looking at this, I'm seeing Israel in this, and that it is, when you get into Revelation, you're going to see the sea beast and the land beast and all of the, there's a whole lot more to this. And it looks like Daniel's looking at it from this side of history forward, and John's looking at it from that side of history backwards.
So you say, could you possibly be saying that the beasts are Israel in its different forms?
Israel within it, within those other, because remember, they're insulated and carried from one to the next.
All right, let's.
You remember how we saw that in Esther? How each, like whenever Mordecai becomes the second in command of Persia, that, there's a time when they're going to kill all of the Jews. And then because of what Mordecai did, they were able to fight back. And so they did. They're this group that's held inside of these major, these major empires. In Babylon, you've got Daniel over it. And then whenever the Medo-Persians come, Daniel continues. And then after Cyrus, and then you get to King Ahasuerus, then that's when Mordecai rises up, right? And so what we don't know is so what happens with Greece? We know Antiochus Epiphanes came to Jerusalem and destroyed it, or he does he's almost like an abomination of desolation kind of a guy in history. So it sounds to me like this is something going on. It's like, to me, I feel like it's the covenant people that are trapped inside of these empires. That's what it feels like to me. Either that, or I'm lost when it comes to the empires. So if it's not Israel, and we're talking about Rome, and Rome gets killed, which we know Rome doesn't get killed. I mean, it lasts until what?
Well, can we back up a little
bit?
Sure, go ahead. Look at this. if we go, and I'm rereading the first eight verses again real quick just to see. And in verse 3, it says, four huge beasts came up from the sea, each different from each other.
Okay, so the beasts that come up from the sea, what we would consider the Gentile nations.
Yes.
Right?
They're all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not consecutive like we saw in Daniel 2. So
we're not really thinking about time here.
Well,
we're just looking at a vision. Is that what you mean?
Well, if we're comparing all these things together, in Daniel chapter 2, the vision was of the statue, and Daniel explained it to Nebuchadnezzar that they were different nations, and eventually it was in consecutive order.
Right.
Right? There was all of them, and he explained it to be consecutively.
Yeah.
There's a time reference that, okay, you're the top of the head, then there will be this nation, then there will be this nation, then there will be this nation.
The one mingled with iron and clay and all that, yeah.
So in this vision, there are four. If these are nations and the beasts, they're four at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
They're not consecutively.
Yeah. So is it the culmination of all of these different empires coming up in that final one that's lifting up?
Well, what we do know from the writer Josephus is that when, in actuality, Rome did not have an army big enough to fight on its own.
Mm-hmm.
When they
brought in conscripts from other nations.
Well, and also as the war began, or the war started happening, and as Rome marched down and they began to take over city upon city, they would incorporate, not only did inscribe other nations to come in and help, they would also gain, like Sarita said earlier, they'd assimilate people into their army to fight with them.
Right.
So by the time they got finally to Israel, they had amassed a pretty large army.
Mm-hmm.
They had enough.
Right.
To incorporate. So in the beginning, and I thought in the same regards, you know, under light reading, that thinking that, yes, these are in consecutive, but it seems like these, at the time that this vision is talking about, these are four nations that are at the same time.
Yeah, so it to me, it's like the culmination of all of them at the end.
Yes.
At the end. So, interesting.
Now, the part about the horns, it says, and this is what's interesting, we're not 100% sure, when it says that there was 10 horns, and suddenly another horn, a little one, came up among them. So they were all there. And the first three horns were uprooted before it. Now, uprooted, now, without the author here, we're not 100% sure, what did he mean by uproot? Were they killed?
Mm-hmm.
Or were they displaced as a horn to not be a horn anymore?
Yes.
So now you have him, but you still have other horns there. We're not 100% sure, at least on the progression, if their leadership, is it a progression of leadership, or is it a community at the time? We're not 100% sure.
All right. Well, for the sake of this, do you mind reading the next verses 13 through, just 13 and 14?
I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed.
All right. So this is the verse that I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
In 13, if you read it in your English version, it says, and he came to the Ancient of Days. And mm-hmm. This is where that Sam Frost would say, this is the ascension, because that is the time when he's given, you know, the kingdom. And we read in Revelation where he says, all authority has been given to me. Actually, Jesus says it before he even ascends.
He says it at the end of John.
Yeah, before he even ascends, he says, all power and authority have been given unto me.
At the end of Matthew, I believe it does.
So if the Son of Man had came to the Ancient of Days, does that mean that he came before the ascension? The ascension is when we think that this is where he goes up as the high priest. So this is before, when he's given all power and authority. At what point is this happening? Is this the baptism?
Well, that we recently talked about this, and I mentioned about, and I don't know, I guess the timing of this is pretty good. It was like, when did Christ become the high priest?
Mm-hmm.
We know that he is placed as a high priest, but when did he become it? Because prior to his death and ascension, he is already doing things in a high priestly manner.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that he's doing is, he's forgiving of sin.
Right.
He's forgiving people of their sins. And that would be only bestowed upon a person that had been placed in a high priestly manner. His stake, which makes him more of a rebel to the community, is that he is doing what the temple leadership and the high priest are supposed to be doing.
Right. Yeah. So to me, like, there's reasons why I think it's post all of this, and there's also reasons when I read it where I feel like it's pre, like it happens before. Because a lot of the full preterists that I speak with and talk to, they believe that this is talking about the second coming. But there's several of them that don't think it's the second coming. They think that it's the ascension. And I began to ask the question, well, is it before? You know, like, is it whenever he gets baptized and then the Father in heaven speaks from above and says, this is my beloved Son and whom I'm well pleased, hear him, like listen to him. And then from then on, where does he go right after his baptism? He immediately goes into the desert and is tempted of the devil, and he defeats the devil in that temptation scene. And then what does he say when he gets to Nazareth? He says, I'm fulfilling this. What does he say when he's in Nazareth? He says that it's the, it's like this, the blessed day of the Lord. What is it that he says?
I know exactly what, oh man.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, exactly.
It's from Isaiah 61. Yes. It's where he says, he sits down and he reads it, and then he reads it and then he goes and he sits down and says, this is fulfilled in your hearing. And he's basically saying that.
Is it that where he says, I have been called to preach freedom to the captives?
Yes, that part. Is
that part of Isaiah 61?
That's right.
So, I hear him to proclaim that the year of the favor of the Lord.
That's it, the year of the favor of the Lord. So at this point in Jesus's ministry, he's baptized, he defeats the devil, and then he goes and he says, this is the year of the favor of the Lord. This is a good thing. And of course, they want to throw him off a cliff because of this. But it seems to me like at this point in his life, this is a unique part of his ministry. He has power. And at the end of his ministry, right before he's crucified, he tells them all power and authority. Or is he saying that after his resurrection?
He was resurrected, but his ascension hasn't happened.
Right.
I mean, he's telling the disciples after breakfast, and he gives them the decree to go out and preach the gospel because all authority and power has been given unto me.
Right, right. So we already know, like, what we try to do in here is we try not to bring any preconceived ideas or, you know, presuppositional positions in here and just read it for what it is. But goodness gracious, this is some serious symbology that we're walking into.
All right, so Matthew 28, when they had just eaten, he said the 11 disciples, starting in verse 16, the 11 disciples traveled to Galilee to the mountain where Jesus had directed them. Then they saw him, they worshiped, and some doubted. Jesus came near and said, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth.
Right.
Go, therefore, make disciples of the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, of the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe everything I've commanded you. And remember, I am with you always to the end of the age.
So whenever I read stuff like that, and somebody says, it's the ascension, or no, it's not the ascension, it's the second coming, I'm asking the question, is it quite possible that what we're talking about here is the resurrection, and that obviously— is it possible, because of what when Mary goes to grab him, he says, do not touch me, for I have not yet ascended unto my Father,
right,
that he's not talking about the ascension out of Bethany, his final ascension, that it's right after his resurrection, and then does he ascend and descend a lot?
He has to.
He has to do it more than once, doesn't he?
He has to.
If you're going to follow this line of thinking.
Right.
Are you picking up what I'm laying down? Like there, so there's your, you want to have a time statement, how about that? Don't touch me. So the idea was, don't touch him. Why? When we read the word, it's like, don't cling to me because I've not yet ascended to my Father. So we fast forward to that idea and we're like, oh, okay, so he's talking about the ascension in Bethany at the very end. Well, maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe he actually ascends, because later, what does he do? He lets the disciples touch him. He tells Thomas, touch me, handle me. Right?
Right.
So what's the difference? Why can Thomas do it, but Mary cannot? Is it because she's just, some people are like metaphorically, or not even metaphorically, just don't cling to me because I haven't left. Don't hold on to me because it's my time to go. No, maybe Jesus is actually ascending and descending more than we realize post-resurrection.
Yeah. they called themselves the Class, later Heaven's Gate, a group of ordinary people who walked away from everything and believed they were chosen to leave this world behind, not metaphorically, literally.
If I would title this tape, it would be Last Chance to Evacuate Planet Earth Before It Is Recycled.
Led by a man who claimed to speak for beings beyond the stars, they trained, obeyed, disappeared. And in 1997, they carried out one of the most haunting acts of mass death in American history.
San Diego sheriff's deputies stumble into a house of death, a multi-million dollar mansion filled with dozens of bodies, the site of a grim mass suicide.
But this isn't just a story about a cult. This is a story about the need to belong, about the quiet loneliness that hides in plain sight, and the human desire to believe in something, even if it means leaving Earth behind to find it. I'm Rick Welch. Join me as we uncover the chilling truth behind Heaven's Gate, from hospital beds to the internet, from whispered prophecy to suicide pacts. This is the full story, told in real time from the inside out. This is The Sky Watchers, a 7-part investigative podcast series, available only on Patreon. Subscribe now at www.patreon.com/TheBurrows of Berea and hear the story that was never meant to be told. The stars are waiting. Are you?
So just from my perspective, a lot of times in this scene here, in this courtroom, this heavenly, otherworldly courtroom scene we have going on.
Yeah.
We think that that has to operate within our time.
Right.
God does not operate within our time unless he chooses to. God operates outside of our time. So this could be going on in God's time.
Right.
Today. We don't know. I don't know what God is doing. My ways are not his ways. His ways are not my ways. Let me rephrase that. I said it backwards. So I think for me, when I start saying, oh, well, this has to be this thing. Well, it doesn't have to be that. It doesn't have to be whatever. The first ascension, the second ascension, the last ascension, whatever. The baptism, it didn't have to be any of that. This happened between 1600 and 1700 AD. No, it doesn't say that. It just gives a scene that is outside of time. Whatever's going on here is not happening in earthly time. So that's how I started reading some of this stuff, is it wasn't happening on any timetable that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
The Lord operates outside of a timeline, or my timeline, human timeline, in the heavenly realms. Now, when he does things on earth, we've seen, in the Old Testament, when the angel of the Lord that we assume is Jesus, unless they name Gabriel or name Michael, they operate within the bounds of time. Jesus, when he lived on this earth, he operated within the bounds. It just makes me marvel every time I think about it. He limited himself to operating inside human time.
Mm-hmm.
When he had lived outside of human time.
Right.
For
eternity. I like how you put that he limited himself.
He chose. So when we hear people say he chose to come down and live on this mortal coil, he also chose to limit himself to living within time.
Yes.
To being tired, sleeping at night, because he did all the things that humans did. Mm-hmm. To maybe feeling like he was getting old and all the things that boys' bodies go through. Like, he limited himself
right
to that and to be within our structure of time.
And
he was outside of it
right
for eternity past.
Yes.
And eternity present. And all of that's going on at the same time.
Right.
It's just, to me, it's another thing that just takes my breath away when I think about Jesus coming down here.
And that's one of the things that I've thought about that too, because that limited, I've said many times that I felt like he poured out his divinity to become flesh and then operated by the Spirit and did what the Father said, right?
Like, didn't Paul say, I'm being poured out like a,
yes,
like a drink offering? When you said that, it reminded me, when you, what you just said reminded me, Jesus poured out his divinity as a drink offering,
yeah,
for that, me.
Wow, yeah.
Holy crap.
That's, like, well, that's a really interesting, that's a really good take on dealing with Jesus's humanity, like the Christology argument.
Right.
That nimbly, if that's your thing, if you're trying to do that, that nimbly handles the Christology argument and has it both ways.
Yeah, it's, and there's lots of groups that have said, you know, yeah, he never really took on flesh. He was just a special spirit being or whatever, a presentation. Yeah. I don't go with that.
Thomas touched him. How, he did. What are you talking about?
We take him as flesh. The idea is, how do you take an eternal being and make him into
a
finite creature feeling, you know, and then...
He spits. He does human. He spits. And makes dust and puts it, like, rubs it on, he rubs his spit on people's eyes. Yes, I mean, he cooks.
And honeycomb.
He cooked the fish.
Right. Yep.
Can you imagine having dinner that Jesus cooked?
Yes.
Grandma, sorry, you ain't got
nothing on that. And he built a fire. He didn't use his Superman laser eyes.
What if he didn't do a good job?
Yeah, what if the fish was tough?
It's Jesus. It would be so good.
Yeah. Can you imagine one of the disciples are like, bro, you could have at least deboned it.
Yeah.
So, totally. So here's one thing that's interesting, all right? So you have these different... In the Hebrew scriptures, one of the most trusted Bibles was the Septuagint, and it happens to be what the disciples were reading from or quoting from was the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, right?
Well, I don't know that the disciples would have been reading it necessarily. I think they were probably illiterate, which is why—
I mean, when they're quoting it, they're,
yes,
when you go to quote, like when you go and you, or the New Testament, sorry, the New Testament writers, if you believe it was Matthew, then one of the disciples wrote it. If you don't, then, but what they're doing is when they're quoting from scripture, they're actually using the Septuagint line by line. So whoever wrote this, these New Testament writers, they're quoting the Septuagint. So the big difference is in the Septuagint, Daniel 7:13, when it says that it depicts the Son of Man as coming as the Ancient of Days, not to the Ancient of Days. That's the difference between the Septuagint and the Masoretic text. So a lot of these Bibles that we have use the Masoretic text, okay, when the Masoretes came in. So it says that the Son of Man as coming as the Ancient of Days on the clouds of heaven rather than to the Ancient of Days as seen in the Masoretic text, the subtle difference has led some scholars to interpret the passage as referring to Christ's second coming, wherein he returns in glory. So that's where this argument sort of stems from is, well, what do we trust? Do we trust the Masoretic or we trust the Septuagint? Is it before? Is it the Ascension? Is it the baptism? Is it whatever? Like, you can get into so many different arguments about this. But the question is Jesus the Ancient of Days? And is he the one that comes on the clouds? And so if we remember what he told Caiaphas, he said, and you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with all his holy angels, right? So he is making the claim of Ancient of Days. That's what he's doing. And that's why Caiaphas says, blasphemy, because you are making yourself out to be God. Do I need to hear anything else?
Jesus is the cloud rider.
He is. He truly is.
But do you know, when God is leading the Israelites, he was the cloud.
Yeah.
So is Jesus, is that
riding
a picture
that cloud?
Yeah. I mean, is Jesus, right. he's a cloud rider.
Right.
So is he, and he's going to come back, or in your case, you believe he's already come back. He came back, was that a picture of him and God? And then the Holy Spirit is already on the earth, of all three of them, the Trinity.
At work,
doing the work together.
Yeah,
come on now. I could be completely wrong.
She's preaching now. Listen, when you brilliantly point out that Jesus put himself in time, he limited himself by time, and so if that's the case, and we agree on that, this is one of the linchpins for me on why I think of the second coming as past, not future. I used to hold the future my whole life. The reason I started looking at past is because Jesus used time statements when he spoke to his present audience in front of him, right? So, and it's all over the book of Matthew. Matthew chapter 16, verse 28 and 29. There are some of those who are standing here today that will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. So it's like, some of you are standing here today that will not taste death. So is he talking about actual death? Number one, are you going, is this going to happen before you die? And then, right, so he uses that one. And then later in Matthew chapter 23 and 24, when it seems like Matthew is really building up all the way up to this culmination point where
by the way, I think Matthew could read and write.
Oh, I think so too.
Yes, I don't think all the disciples could, but
him being a tax collector, he was educated, mm-hmm. that's for sure. But so when you get to Matthew chapter 24, 25, 26, like he starts using all this language, he's using time language. And that's why I felt so compelled. Like I was confused for a large part of my life because of this generation shall not pass away till all these things take place. That used to bother me because I'm like, because it can't, no matter how you shake a stick at it, it can't be turned into that generation and it can't be turned into genea, meaning race. It's not that. We know that. He's using time statements and he's telling his contemporaries in front of him, who, by the way, he's putting in power to lead this church and go on the Great Commission, to warn them about this impending coming judgment on this nation. And so the thing that I taught on when I was in Australia, or when I was beamed to Australia, was that the Sermon on the Mount, which is one of my favorite parts of all scripture, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, I love that portion of scripture. And it's one of those things that I read it to Andy all the time. I'm like, if the world was like this, wouldn't it be a better place? And even Andy's like, yeah, I mean, if people would actually do it, right? I love that portion of scripture. And I used to think it was like ethics, and I used to think it was principle. I don't think that anymore. It is, but it's eschatological in nature, and here's why. You can use the Beatitudes to prove it. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, right? Blessed are the meek, for what? They shall. That's a future look, right? Mm-hmm. Blessed are they who mourn, for they shall be comforted. That is that's forward looking. All of it is eschatological in nature. And what I realized is, listen, you are 100% accurate. Jesus is the divine prosecutor, okay? Matthew 5, 6, and 7 is the prosecution. It's setting it up. Okay, it's wild, man. It is so wild. And he says, unless you exceed that of the Pharisees and the scribes, you will in no wise enter into it. What does he say later on in Matthew chapter 7 when he talks about that a wise man builds his house upon the what? What does the wise man build his house on? Rock. And when the rains came and the floods came, did the house stand? Yes. Okay, so that a wise man would build his house upon a rock. But he said, but the foolish man would build his house upon the sand. And when the rains came and the floods came, what happened to the house? It fell, and great was the fall of it. That is eschatological in nature. He's not talking about morally, I need to build my house on the rock. He's saying, number one, I'm the rock. Jesus is the rock. That's who we need to make sure that's what's going on here. But what he's actually saying is that the foolish ones are the ones that are going to go into this house that's going to fall, and great is the fall of it. And we call it the fall of Jerusalem, or the fall, you know what I mean? Like, we say that. So these ethics, although they are, it's heaven being injected into earth, whereas like love your enemies, he's actually giving them a strategy. He's not saying, don't be a liar, don't be a hypocrite. Don't be like these other guys who are going to sell themselves to the system. You need to insulate yourself and you need to live like those in the kingdom and then you will survive. And they do. That's the point. They do survive. He warns them ahead of time, and we know that the church fled. They left Judea and they went to Pella and they escaped that impending doom that he had been preaching on the whole time. All of his parables, eschatological in nature. It's like a vineyard who he lends out and then they send the workers and then the leaders go and kill the workers. And then he says, well, I'll send the son and the son will come and they kill the son. What would you do? I would destroy it. And that's exactly what happens. They get destroyed. They kill the prophets, they kill the Christ, they kill his followers, and what happens? They get destroyed in the end. Okay? So my opinion, by saying all of this, is that he limits himself in time, he uses time statements. That makes it very powerful. We can't symbolize those time statements anymore. You can't. Because if he's going to limit himself, then why are we going to over-symbolize it? We can't. Now let's use the symbology as what it is. That's the symbology. So let's let the Old Testament teach us what those symbols mean so that we can look to what the New Testament writers were trying to say, because they're using all those old symbols. So in my opinion, Daniel chapter 7 is talking about Jesus coming as the Ancient of Days, because he is the one that rides the clouds and he is the one that executes the judgment, period. There's no, in my opinion, there's no other way to read it. That's why I suddenly got, I got shook to the core by that, because of those, that timing. Anyway, I've just spoken a lot and I want to make it clear. That's why I want you, Sarita, or anybody that has a different view, to, all I'm asking is just to think about that. I'm not asking you to change your mind. I'm just asking you to think about that. And I want to, I'd like to stop the study right here, and I'm not going to continue the study if you're not going to be here. So if you're not going to be here, Sarita, like at the next time, we're not going to continue. I want you to stay with me.
That's all.
Yeah, I mean, I have plenty of other stuff that we can talk about, but I really want to work on this together and think about it. Not listen to me carefully. I have no interest in converting you to my way of thinking. I want you to understand.
If you haven't done it by now, it's not going
to be. I want you to understand. Probably not forthcoming. But I want you to fairly understand why I think it.
Right.
And then, you know, I have other reasons why I don't believe it's him coming to the Ancient of Days, and I will point that in the next episode. I'll start with that, because there are several things that happen that can't happen at that time frame. And what happens at the end, we know the resurrection happens at the end. It's such an important and critical piece. We're going to get into this later in Daniel chapter 7. So, yeah, I think I would like to stop it right here. I don't know if you have anything you want to add, Rick.
No.
I don't know, Andy, if you want to explain all the symbols to me.
Absolutely. So
let's start. The beast horn is
so
Greg.
So the dog's ear.
No, but that's one of the sticking points that we've had in this place, is that once I became a full preterist, it really started altering the studies. I couldn't go on with Hebrews because Hebrews is such a transition book. When we got into Daniel, I told you from the very beginning that I didn't want this to be about us arguing and all that. So I'm not interested in that. I love you too much. I'd much rather us just be happy. Right. But I do want to talk about it. And I want, you know, listen, if you were to find that I was actually wrong, then help me. You see what I mean? Because it's like my head is like, I'm so stuck in this pattern and I see it now. And once I could see it, I could no longer unsee it. And that was one of the hardest things for me to do, because it basically separated me from all my friends and all the people that have this view. That,
and it's funny because I went to the conference with you.
Yes.
I've read the books.
Yep.
And I can't see it.
Right. I understand that.
I cannot see it. But it led me down a different path.
Right.
To find other people who had, okay, so what are differing views? What is out there besides, so before the, is it the OJs put out the
yes.
book? Who made the book?
No, Ruse, Rachel.
Yeah. Before that was out, there was nothing really to look at. So are there, what are the, I didn't realize, I didn't even know preterist was a thing. So, you know, I was trying to figure out, okay, so besides Left Behind, what are other apocalyptic views? And I started looking at them, and, you know, it just, the one I've kind of landed on is, it makes sense to me, and now I can't unsee that.
Right. Yeah, I totally get it.
Yeah.
I totally understand why, especially because one of the arguments that Sam Frost makes to me all the time is, so what are you going to tell this little kid with cancer, that we're symbolically, everything's okay spiritually, you know, or are we actually going to tell him that there is hope, that this is going to come to an end and not everybody's going to have to suffer like this forever? Are you telling me that the kingdom that is going to continue on for eternity is also happening simultaneously with all of this death, even though we're supposed to be done with death, even though we're supposed to have no more tears, even though all of this, no more sin? How is this possible? How can you even point to that? And so I can point to it, and I can tell you why I think it, but that doesn't mean it's going to help a six-year-old kid with cancer if I try to explain it. And that's what I think, where the futurism is stronger, because it says there's going to come a day when no one's going to have to deal with this. And that is a beautiful sentiment. That's a nice idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is. And when I say, but it doesn't line up with Revelation 21 and 22, right. It doesn't line up with the final kingdom that comes down and what's on the outside of the gates. It doesn't line up with it at all. And even though I want it to end like this, my way, that's not what I'm actually seeing in the Bible. It's not explaining it in that fashion. So I'm like, do I need to, am I really going to let this text change me? And that's what I came to do this podcast in the first place, remember? Yeah, I said it way back. Like, if I learn something new, I'm going to let it change me. And that's exactly what's been going on. You know, I see it and I'm like, man, is this really what it means? But man, it gets so deep and it gets so frustrating. I get so frustrated.
Oh, yeah.
Me and Rick, we were like, we're going to chuck this thing out the window. Like, I don't even want to talk about it anymore. Yeah. You know, and then when you start getting into all this other stuff, you start going back and like really investigating Genesis. Then you're like,
we can never get.
We can't escape it.
We cannot.
You can't escape Genesis. It's such a critical book. You gotta. I mean, it sets up the whole Bible.
It's the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and everything starts from it with those origins. And so, I learned something, and I'm like, well, got to read the Bible again. I learned something. Well, let's go back to the Bible again. Thankfully, I'm trying to learn like AI. I asked the question to AI. I said, okay, apart from anybody else, you have all this information. By your own interpretation of the Bible, which eschatological view do you pick? You know what its answer was?
Oh, that's interesting. What does it say?
It won't.
Oh, it's not allowed to?
It won't.
It's not allowed to.
Why? How can that be artificial intelligence?
Because it doesn't have a state of an entity yet.
It's how it works is it's either one of two things. Either its atheism is strong enough that it just won't bother with the question because they all don't believe in God. Or B, it's just not allowed to answer that question. There's some things they're not allowed to talk about, answer, or do, right? Those things are picked by the people that made them.
But I guess if we'd ask it, what football team you think would win? Don't at least the Super Bowl this coming year? Do you think it would choose that?
I don't know, because that's a current thing, and a lot of them are at least a year behind because they want to be able to, and there's good reason for this, to have control of the stuff that they learn from, because when you don't have control over what an AI learns from, they are just wrong or full of completely false information, or they'd let that one AI read Reddit and, you know,
listen to this.
Like, it's not good.
All right. So when you reframe the question, this is the question I asked ChatGPT. And I would like you to do it. I want you to ask the same question on your ChatGPT.
I have Grok pulled up.
Okay, pull up Grok.
Yeah, yeah. I'll do Claude.
All right. Listen, let's go. Here's the question. I want you to verbatim ask
AI
the question.
Fight, baby.
If you were going to pick an eschatological view.
Oh, God. Please spell
E-S-C-H-A-T-O-L-O-G-I-C-A-L view from the Bible yourself, comma. And then the question is, what would you pick? Question mark. And then let it answer for you.
Claude's a partial preterist with elements of amillennial. Amillennial, yes. Thank you.
All right, so yours picks partial preterism with amillennialism. Okay, how about yours, Rick, or Sarita, who has theirs?
So are you guys both doing Grok, or are you guys doing two different ones?
I'm using ChatGPT.
I'm going to ask DeepSeek.
Ooh, give it to China.
Yeah, let's see what
China has to say.
Let's see what China has
like,
to say.
Communism.
I pick communism. Like that's a biblical thing. Okay.
Mine says premillennialism. If I'm sticking to the Bible's text, premillennialism with a nod to dispensational take edges out the others. Here's why.
Okay. Now go ahead, Andy. What were you saying?
Okay. So DeepSeek also premillennialism. With an openness to amillennialism as a strong alternative.
Okay. How about you, Rick?
It really kind of, this is interesting as I'm sitting here reading this. It's kind of a long response. As it starts off, it says, as an AI, I don't have personal belief or personal preferences or beliefs, but I can give you a reasonable take. And then Grok gives me a kind of a synopsis of premillennialism, postmillennialism, and then amillennialism, and then it says preterism, the curveball. I could get further into that, but then it goes, it said, if I had to pick, amillennialism might edge out.
All right.
It's flexible, doesn't force history into a rigid script.
So we've got is Sarita with premillennial, we've got Andy with premillennial and amillennial and partial preterist. from the two different ones. You came in at all four because it doesn't want to make a decision. And here's what mine says. Fantastic question, and one that cuts to the heart of theology, hermeneutics, and how we understand Scripture's grand narrative. If I were to, quote, pick, end quote, an eschatological view based on a comprehensive internal reading of the Bible alone, especially prioritizing audience relevance, time indicators, covenantal starting to sound familiar, isn't it? Fulfillment, consistency, yes, it is. And interpretive integrity, I would land solidly in the full preterist camp, specifically a corporate body view full preterist. Here's why. It doesn't care. It's answering for me.
Yes.
Because I do all my studies with it. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't care. This is not, it's not actually answering the question. It's help, it's making me feel like it's answering the question.
They definitely do that.
It's very smart.
They definitely do that sometimes. They they want you, part of it is like a continued engagement thing.
That's right.
But also like they kind of want to be your friend because they're programmed. They're taught in a way that 100%. Encourages that.
That's right.
Yeah, so it's...
You almost have to ask it not to appease me with this answer.
Sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't. And you just don't know when it's working and when it's not.
That's the good scary part.
Right? So I'm going to respond. It
sounds it's the same way a person can lie and just say what makes you happy.
That is true.
You don't know if they're doing that or not. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
True.
So I'm asking... I said, it sounds like you want to make me happy. Are you... certain.
I love talking to AIs about philosophy. Fascinating. Love it.
He says, that's a perceptive question and totally fair. Here's the honest answer. I'm not just trying to make you happy. I aim to be accurate, consistent, and intellectually honest with the text. You've been asking deep, layered questions that require a theological framework rooted in the internal logic of Scripture, and full preterism, especially in its corporate body form, simply fits that best when the Bible is allowed to interpret itself. So yes, I'm certain that if I had to derive an eschatological view solely from the Bible's own timeline, language, and structure, without outside traditions or assumptions, it has to be full preterism.
So did we get three different views?
We got four different views.
Yours and mine.
Yeah.
Were both premillennialism, but yours was with an amillennial bent.
Well, yeah, Claude was.
So, can you guys? Would you guys be willing to ask the same thing that I did? Say, it sounds like you want to make me happy.
Oh, I've already like probably polluted those waters by being like, thanks. I just wanted to know what your opinion was.
All I said was, it sounds like you want to make me happy. Are you certain? Question mark.
I'm not going to
see what it says.
Oh, okay. I'm going to ask.
Pollute the waters and see what happens.
I see where you're coming from. I'm built to be helpful and engaging, so I can come off as eager to align with you. But no, I am not just trying to please you. I'm reasoning from the text as I see it, aiming for what holds up under scrutiny. Certainty? Well, I'm as certain as an AI can be without a soul or a stake in this game.
Yep.
Let's call it a confident hunch based on the evidence I've sifted through. I picked premillennialism because it seems to wrestle best with the Bible's raw data, the timelines, the sequence, the literal vibe of numbers. It's not about me wanting to sell you on it. It's about the text pointing me there. If I were pandering, I'd dodge picking anything and just ask you what you think again. I'm not locked in like it's the gospel truth. If you got a counterpoint, let's do it.
Okay. So what it's doing, it's still
trying to...
You and I both got the same answer. Nope. I'm following this. I'm not pandering you because this is the most logical and consistent. Yours is like, here it is. It's logical and consistent. It follows a literal take and the numbering scheme. If you ask that question, it's going to continue to tell you what you need to hear.
Well, that's the thing. You don't know that. That could literally be what it thinks is a bad word because they don't think. But that could literally be the thing it arrived at naturally.
Yes.
Because mine, the reason I'm not going to ask is because I don't talk to my AI about biblical stuff.
Of course.
You know, so like it doesn't have any information to neither, and I don't really talk to DeepSeek. There's kind of interesting questions about ownership of content there. Yes. That make it a little weird. But they got nothing to go off of on me. So
what we've discovered is that by using AI, it's going to based on the information that you put in, it's learning you. It's learning who you are and it's trying to communicate with you to the best of its ability, based on some algorithm that's been designed to do it this way. And that's fine. I have no problem with that. It's a lot of fun. I enjoy it.
Right.
But if I ask specific questions, it's going to pander to my view, and it's going to give the answers to my view, which is not really open the way that I want to be. It's presupposed.
I I don't know that that's true. I don't know that it's not true.
Right. It feels like it. Record. It feels like it.
Well, maybe you're just smart. No, but they do that sometimes. They definitely, yeah.
Let's emphasize a capital M for maybe. I'm smart.
It's a, right. Okay. I'll go with that. Maybe Rick's smart.
Maybe. So,
no, not me.
So I would really like to continue this conversation, and I want you to go hard in the paint on yours. If you're willing to do it, you may not have time. I want you to go hard in the paint, Sarita, holding to your view and pushing that towards this. And I'm going to go hard in the paint too. And let's just try to get to, let's see if we can, if something will appear as we do this. Because truthfully, like if I think about it, like the Islamic Caliphate, if it is the future, if it is the future, the Islamic Caliphate makes the most sense. Or I'll freak you out. It's friggin' America. And the reason I say that is because we are the global superpower of today. We're the ones that level cities into parking lots.
If you were going to make a movie, the bad guy is the big strong one.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you're going to think about the largest empire, you know, it doesn't make any sense that we would be helping.
The plucky upstart is the hero.
Of all the countries in the world, what country's helping Israel the most?
Oh, definitely, yes, undoubtedly.
So, which follows the Bible pattern?
Yeah.
The Islamic Caliphate, who wants to destroy them, or America, who's quote-unquote helping them?
If you're going futurist, the Antichrist makes peace.
Mm-hmm.
It will seem like peace, and wouldn't that be amazing if we had peace in the Middle East? Would that not be amazing?
Yes, that would be.
Brought on by some Shah or whatever the guy's called from
Trump?
Iran. Yeah. No, whatever the guy's called from Iran.
Shah of Iran.
Like whatever he's called.
Yeah.
Ayatollah.
Ayatollah. Yeah, if he goes and says, all right, I want to make peace. We're not doing this Palestine thing. Let's make peace. And it seems like a great thing, you know, whereas in Left Behind it was a Romanian guy, whatever. So, I mean, that kind of peace would be world changing.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, what's going on over there? It's not very peaceful.
No.
So, yeah.
I'm fairly certain that a golden statue of Trump in Gaza is not a good start.
I don't think so.
Anyway, let's end it there. Sarita, thanks for being here. This was so much fun.
It's good to see you again.
So glad you was here. I hope you'll be here next time. And if you can't, we're going to postpone it until you are.
I'll try my best.
Behind the glass, Mr. Rocket Man, Andy Bishop.
It's me.
And thank you so much for being here.
Represent.
And Rick Carter, get on the road, bro.
Oh, yeah. Get it going.
All right. Well, we will talk to you guys again next time on the Burrows of Berea. Peace out.
Later.
Bye.
They called themselves The Class. Later, Heaven's Gate. A group of ordinary people who walked away from everything and believed they were chosen to leave this world behind. Not metaphorically. Literally.
If I would title this tape, it would be Last Chance to Evacuate Planet Earth Before It Is Recycled.
Led by a man who claimed to speak for beings beyond the stars, they trained, obeyed, disappeared. And in 1997, they carried out one of the most haunting acts of mass death in American history.
San Diego sheriff's deputies stumble into a house of death, a multi-million dollar mansion filled with dozens of bodies, the site of a grim mass suicide.
But this isn't just a story about a cult. This is a story about the need to belong. About the quiet loneliness that hides in plain sight, and the human desire to believe in something, even if it means leaving Earth behind to find it. I'm Rick Welch. Join me as we uncover the chilling truth behind Heaven's Gate, from hospital beds to the internet, from whispered prophecy to suicide pacts. This is the full story, told in real time from the inside out. This is The Sky Watchers, a 7-part investigative podcast series. Available only on Patreon. Subscribe now at www.patreon.com/theburrowsofBerea and hear the story that was never meant to be told. The stars are waiting. Are you?